From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. We are returning to the world of food conspiracies. What are you eating? What's the last thing you ate? What's the next thing you're going to eat after you hear this show?
Leftover Chinese,
leftover turkey for a lot of people, because as we record today's episode, folks, we are hurtling toward the end of 2020. And as you are hearing this, post-Thanksgiving, just to get this out of the way very quickly, pandemic rates will have shot up in the United States. People will die.
Yeah, I heard a stat today that it was, I think, maybe a third of the Thanksgiving travel from last year, but still like the most traffic airports have seen since the pandemic began. They're saying like a million people a day. So people aren't paying super close attention to the experts, and that's just a little troubling.
Yeah, I can't remember which show I mentioned this on, but earlier I found some of the same information, and one of the most troubling things is that historically the busiest day for airports every year in the U.S. is the Sunday after Thanksgiving. So be careful if you have to travel. Anyhow, all of this is not a conspiracy. In fact, we predicted a pandemic in earlier episodes, not because we're some sort of clairvoyance or precogs or something, just because statistically it was a certainty. Today, Matt, Noel, Mission Control, and yours truly are exploring something a little bit lighter. This is the last episode we're recording before we go to a Thanksgiving break. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is often a pretty heavy meal of ugly truths and, we hope, worthwhile information. But as we head to parts unknown this weekend, what we'd like to do with this episode is offer more something like a series of tapas. You know what I mean? A little taste. A grab bag, if you will, of some of our favorite food-related conspiracies and urban legends. Longtime listeners, you know that we've covered stuff like this in the past. We just keep finding more weird things about food.
Before we dive in, can I bust one myth real quick? You don't need to brine your turkey. Hot take. I don't know how people feel about this. I found out that what brining a turkey does is, you know, the salt causes osmosis. So the turkey takes in all this water, the salt water. And, you know, you can season the brine as well. But that gives the illusion of juiciness. But the juiciness is not really the juiciness of the turkey. It's just water that's been absorbed into the turkey. So while that definitely will give you a juicier bird, you can get that same effect just by, like, doing a nice butter garlic rub under the skin and then letting it rest long enough so that the juices actually begin to kind of flow. So that's from Gordon Ramsay to my ears, to your ears, just putting that out there. And that's what I'm doing this year. Hopefully it was actually successful. This is obviously happening in the past now, but I'm really feeling strong about it.
Well, you heard it here, everyone. Do not brine your turkeys. Gordon Ramsay says so. And I listen to anything that man says. Honestly, I think he's pretty awesome.
Yeah, he's really nice in person, actually.
I that's what I hear from everybody. Instead, hopefully all of you took your oil, you know, your large vats of oil where you're going to fry your turkeys, put them outside maybe on your wooden porch and did it there. And, you know, hopefully only a small percentage of you burned your porch down.
Hopefully some folks did the beer can turkey recipe. That thing is, that's pretty fun. But, you know, there's ritual, I think, involved in creating a Thanksgiving meal. And sometimes that ritual becomes even more important than the culinary science, right? You cook the way that one of your older relatives taught you in the days of old. And that'll happen again toward the end of the year because these sorts of traditional meals are very important in human culture, which makes me sound a bit like a robot, but I am technically correct. So let's see what we find in this dive into the world of food conspiracies, and let's see what we can actually prove. This is a little topsy-turvy because we're going to start with some terrible things that are absolutely true, and then we'll get to the fun stuff. So here are the facts. First, many of the terrible, terrible things you have heard about the food you eat, about the way it's grown, about the way it's sold, transported, processed, given to you, all of those terrible things are true. A lot of them. I mean, nutrition is power. The power balance is skewed. Millions of people are starving right now, while other people are fighting about the quote-unquote right way to eat caviar or ortolan or you know, like, where's the good coffee or whatever.
Does he have a special spoon for caviar? Is that a thing? It's like a caviar spoon? Okay.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I've never had it before. Is it good?
The spoon or the – you can't eat the spoon. It's not like
no, I don't think I've ever had caviar before. Maybe in a dish – a fancy dish, but I've never eaten it like on its own. That sounds like something you might have tried, Ben.
Do fish eggs incorporated into a sushi dish count as caviar?
I don't believe so. They're different. Mm-mm.
Then caviar, I've never had caviar either.
Very specific kind of, oh God, it's a whole thing. I think the emperor has no clothes as far as that goes. But yeah, it's true. There are a lot of inequalities in our food system. And then there are a lot of... It might sound hyperbolic to say it, but there are a lot of vampiric corporations that are heavily influencing the food and beverage industry.
Like, Nestle. I'm sorry.
Right, right. Well, bless you. But, you know, there are powerful companies that are bending the laws to their whim.
Yeah. And they've got a bunch of really long straws that go underground and they drink our collective milkshakes.
Mm-hmm. And one of the big ones is Nestle. Not for nothing. That's not our opinion. You can easily look that up. Third, and this is another bummer, absolutely true, plastic. Boy, we got so much feedback on our microplastics episode, and it is all correct, and it is all terrifying.
Yeah, it's everywhere, on the lands, in the seas, on the seas, in your body.
Yeah. Legos. Just going to leave it there. What about the food pyramid, guys? That was a thing that was like on posters in our like elementary school classrooms and, praises sung, like worshipful to the food pyramid. That's obviously a thing that we still rely heavily upon in our nourishment, at least in terms of a visual aid, right?
Yeah, it has been for a long time. It's changed a lot over the years.
Yeah. The food pyramid is kind of a crock. This is not to say that there isn't solid science involved, but unfortunately, the pyramid was, at least in the past, heavily influenced by the food industry, by powerful lobbying groups in that sphere. You can see multiple books that claim that sort of influence exists today and that these companies exert a lot of agency and power on the USDA and especially like milk companies get accused of influencing the Department of Agriculture into, you know, tilting the pyramid their way.
Yeah. But if you're interested in learning more about that, I would recommend everybody, if you're in the US, go to choosemyplate.gov, which is actually in my opinion, a pretty good nutritional guide that's set up for personal use for an individual person or family, where you can actually kind of make your own food pyramid of what you should be eating and where you could be getting your nutrients.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. That I have not checked that out before, man. I'm going to pull that up. I would also recommend checking out a book by Michael Pollan called The Omnivore's Dilemma. The Omnivore's Dilemma is pretty – it has a very simple diet that is summed up like this. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. I'm not here to proselytize. I just like the way it's written. So check that out because we have to consider the source when we look at things like industry influence science. In any case. So these are all bummers, right? This is all kind of bad news. We usually take careful time to explore the stories behind those four or five things that we just mentioned. You can learn more about this in previous episodes. We've also done work on the weird sugar cover-up that occurred in the U.S. We've examined stories about chocolate and cocoa and, of course, palm oil. You can find that in previous episodes. But today, just to take a break from this very, very crazy year, we thought it would be interesting to delve into some of that that rogues gallery of urban legends about food, all the weird stuff you heard growing up, all the things that maybe like that guy who lived down the hallway from your first apartment would just sometimes like mutter, you know, the weird out of the blue stuff people really seem to believe. What are we talking about? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. Here's where it gets crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, food is a necessity. Gotta have it to survive, gotta have it to get things done. It's something that we have in common with all other humans, despite our many, many differences. So it shouldn't surprise anyone that we've evolved an incredibly complex and dense, dare we say, folkloric kind of system around food and you know, the idea of it being an art form, or the idea of it representing all kinds of different cultural rituals and various other aspects of life that are kind of embodied through the food we eat and the way we prepare it and the way we eat it and the way we make it kind of like a factor in community, right? So the world of mass marketed food is inherently conspiratorial because it's almost like the antithesis to that in some ways, or it's sort of like it's easy to look at it as kind of the big, bad, corporate, lazy answer to like all the things that are lovely and wonderful about food. So if you're listening to this in the United States, a question to you is it not somewhat weird that you can eat almost anything?
Mm-hmm.
Except for that Orlaton, right? Orlaton.
Ortolan.
Ortolan, right. whatever the little tiny bird
fried
is.
Songbird.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hide your, and you have to have the napkin or a cloth over your head so that God doesn't see you enjoying yourself. That's literally the process.
It is. And really quickly, I had a friend who is a very, very adventurous eater and went to, I want to say the Philippines, and he ate those 100-year-old eggs, the balut, which are like, maybe that's different. 100-year-old eggs are different. Sorry, mm-hmm. Excuse me. Balut is like an fertilized or a partially fertilized chicken egg, where it's inside of the hard-boiled egg is a little tiny bird fetus. And apparently you eat them warm and he said it tastes like chicken soup. Yeah. He said it was delightful, but the concept of it squigs me out big time.
Yeah. You eat the whole thing. And I've had it before. I think the main thing that turns people off about it is that appearance, you know, this partially developed creature, but it's still way better than a century egg. The 100-year egg that you're describing, we ate some of that on a weird Facebook show we used to do called Stack Stuff, and that stuff was gross. Like it is the definition of an acquired taste.
Well, okay. Have you? Let me just ask you guys a question. You guys seem like adventurous eaters. Have either of you tried tripe before?
Yes.
In pho. I've had it in as like a extra ingredient in pho, but I've never had haggis or never really had like, well, haggis and tripe are the same. I've never really eaten it like on its own. I've had sweetbreads, which isn't quite the same. That's thalamus, if I'm not mistaken, but that's about as adventurous as I've got in that department. Ben, you did an immediate yes.
Yes.
Because tripe is in actual intestine.
Correct.
Right? One thing I have to admit here is that I'm a big fan of sausage. I think it's maybe the German parts of me or something. Something in my blood very much enjoys a pork intestine encased meat.
A wurst, the schnitzel.
Yeah, but the thought of just eating intestines just alone, no matter how it's prepared, grosses me out. And I think it's just a, I know it's the same kind of deal with the balut. Like the thought of it is much worse than the actual act or the flavor or anything like that.
Oh, a couple things. Okay, first off, one of my favorite restaurants in the world for some reason is a place called St. John's in the United Kingdom. The chef is a guy named Fergus Henderson, and he has been credited with, quote-unquote, resurrecting British cooking. This guy cooks with every part of the animal, especially the stuff that's usually considered awful and thrown away. And this comes to, it's funny that you guys bring this up because just a few days ago, I received their newest publication. I love his cookbooks, actually. And this one's called The Book of St. John. And there is an entire chapter on tripe. He goes ham with it. Wait, not on purpose. Not that great, but I would love to cook it for you guys sometime. Post-pandemic, let's see if it's good. I've actually been to the restaurant and it is surprisingly good, but there's some weird stuff there.
I like liver. I like gamier meats. I like obviously chicken thighs, which isn't the same thing as awful, but I've had heart. Heart is tasty. It's very like hearty.
There it is.
That was absolutely not on purpose. Yeah, but it is. It has a really, it's almost like steak. Like it really is like a very muscular piece of meat. I don't find it gross at all. I think the things that I find gross are things that are squishy or in some ways have an odd texture. But yeah, I don't, it doesn't really turn me off inherently.
I'm glad you said squishy because that brings us to the first big conspiracy we want to talk about today, right?
It does. Just to sew this up, this is the point I want to make anybody who feels very close-minded about food or nutrition, or anybody who has the audacity, the temerity to look at another culture and say, oh, it's gross that you eat that. If you're in the U.S., I would ask you to consider just how f-ing strange it is that cheese exists. Like, cheese is a weird thing.
And it's so normalized in our minds. It's just, we think of it as like this nice kind of pale orange block that we can just slice off pieces of and make a grilled sandwich with. But the process of it is really strange. And if you really dig down deep into it, it's an odd concept. Like, it's one of those things where, like, who figured that out? It was obviously an accident, right? Like, letting the milk curdle and what is it, scraping off the gross gelatinous surface that forms on top and then processing it further.
Yeah, but it's a form of saving food that was going to go bad. Right?
True. You're right.
I mean, so much food innovation comes from that need to stock up on something when food supplies are limited.
Yeah, I just bring that up because when it comes to cuisine, a thing that everybody has in common, we're all in a glass house or a glass restaurant. So I would be very careful when throwing stones or looking down one's nose at another person's plate.
We really should be outdoor seating, by the way.
It should be out. Yes, it should be outdoor seating. But Matt, you had the perfect segue. There's something we have to talk about that may ruin one particularly popular appetizer in the U.S. It's weird how normal it is to be able to hop online in any major city and get almost any food you want, virtually any food. Historically, if you live hundreds and hundreds of miles inland, you should not be able to get seafood, right? There's not a water source from which to take that fish. But now it is very common to say, hey, let's splurge a little. Let's get some calamari. You know what I mean? Let's get some fried, lovely squid. Little squeeze of lemon on there. You know what I mean?
I remember when I first started like encountering calamari, it did feel like a very like special occasion kind of dish. Like it was, and because it was exotic feeling, like, ooh, squid, squiggy, squiggly, squishy squid that's fried to a delightful golden brown and then dipped in marinara sauce or some kind of, what do you call it? Aioli perhaps. But yeah, you know, the ones you can't go wrong when they're the ones that have the little tentacles and they're the little heads. That's definitely, you're in good shape there. You're in good hands with whomever is serving you those little babies. But the rings is where things can go horribly south.
Yeah, yeah. You got to get the Cthulhu calamari, okay? You want a Lovecraft aspect to your calamari because it may not always be the squid you think it is. At least according to some rumors, right? This is the part of the episode where we have to say allegedly. So allegedly, the calamari might be something different. Cough, cough, it is often. Cough, cough.
Really?
It's happened, man. It's happened.
I don't think so. I don't think it's happened at all. Honestly, I've got to take that stance right now because Well, let's talk about it first, but I disagree with you, but let's go.
Yeah, yeah, I'm into it. So back in 2013, this allegation garnered national attention when it was the subject of an episode of This American Life, a fantastic show. And this was sort of conspiratorial. The allegation here was that the calamari that people order in restaurants is sometimes not from squid, but from pigs, specifically their rectums, their intestines.
To Matt's point, I do want to posit, are the rectums just so cleanly removable that they would just instantly resemble? And also, it's like you get one calamari ring per pig. That's a big investment of livestock, is all I'm saying here.
Yeah, it's more, I think using the word rectum is more for clickbait or buzz value.
So, okay.
It would really just be the intestine itself cut into rings.
Yes. That's a thing that has been bandied about for many years. While, again, to Matt, you may completely disagree with this, we don't definitively know or have proof of this has happened on some kind of large scale. We do know that counterfeit seafood absolutely does. Whether it's, you know, well-meaning mislabeling, right, or maybe in cooking, perhaps. Like it would be less of a thing if you went into a fish market and they were selling you something under the guise of being fresh snapper and it was actually some other trash fish. But Matt, we got to give you your day in court. What is your misgivings about this pig butthole phenomenon?
Well, I was just doing some reading about it. Slate has a great write-up on that episode of This American Life and that specific segment that came from a producer, Ben Calhoun. And it literally was a friend of a friend story that was just retold, essentially, in within This American Life. And, you know, it upon further looking at it and really considering it, calamari or, you know, squid, frozen versions of it are widely available. They're fairly inexpensive and you can charge a good amount of money for it. So it's one of those menu items where only in the most desperate of situations, I think, would anyone, step to trying to get one over on their customers to instead put tripe of some sort or pig intestines of some sort in the mix rather than just, buying some fairly inexpensive calamari and then selling it at a price that they could.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I've read the same thing. Here's how I would respond. These kinds of stories often get exaggerated, right? So is there a widespread calamari conspiracy? Probably not, I grant. Financially, it doesn't make as much sense. And legally, according to Uncle Sam, anything containing a pork product has to be labeled as such. However, has this happened in isolated, perhaps desperate instances? The answer is quite possibly, because there are numerous blind spots in the supply chain. I would not characterize a restaurant maybe selling counterfeit calamari as some sort of devious penny-pinching institution. I would say they may have been built as well somewhere in the supply chain, because the issue here is that counterfeit seafood, right, the true conspiracy here, counterfeit seafood is a real ongoing thing. No one has conclusively proven a routine practice of subbing out squid for pig intestines, but that lack of oversight is what compels people to say, I don't know, it's possible. But someone would have to be in a very unique financial arrangement for this to make sense. But the counterfeit seafood stuff, man, it goes way deeper than a pig's butt.
For sure. I wanted to bring one up really quickly. Again, that's something that, you know, you've got imitation crab. It's labeled as imitation crab. I really am not quite sure what imitation crab is made of. But you have scallops, for example. Scallops sometimes can be cookie cutter punch outs of like stingray or what else?
Shark as well. Mm-hmm. There's an interesting report just last year from an outfit called Oceana, and they found that 21% of the seafood in the U.S. is being served somehow under what we could call a fake identity. I love that you mentioned scallops, Noel. Things like lobster, catfish, flounder, halibut, a ton of fish are often, to be diplomatic, mislabeled. And there's also some marketing in here that's totally legal, like Chilean sea bass.
Spared no expense. Remember that was the meal in Jurassic Park, the nice Chilean sea bass.
That's right. Yeah. The real name for Chilean sea bass is Patagonian toothfish.
Yum.
And you can pull up a picture. It's not going to win the fish beauty contest.
Have you ever heard the expression toothsome?
Yes. Yeah.
Does that mean you got a lot of teeth or that something has a nice texture to it?
Yeah, it's texture. Yeah, which, you know, something that I find very toothsome is this imitation crab meat. This one's from Transocean. This is one of my son's favorite snacks.
What's it made of, Matt? Wait, I just brought it up a minute ago. Yeah,
whitefish, right?
That's why I'm bringing it to you. Alaska pollock. That's what's in this one. Water, egg whites, cornstarch, sugar. Oh, God. King crab meat is in this.
Just
a dash.
2% or less of king crab meat. Uh-huh. Or blue crab meat extract, or lobster, or refined fish oil. Jesus.
Oh, this is like a choose your own adventure ingredient list.
I feed this to my son. He loves it.
You don't know what you're feeding him each time. It could be crab. It could be lobster.
Oh, God.
Well, you know, honestly, there are some dishes with which I prefer to use imitation crab. But I was not aware of that, Matt. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. I don't think I've seen an ingredient list that goes down into an either or situation. I didn't know that was legal.
It does seem a little fishy.
There it is.
You know what? I was wrong with the or. There are a couple ors, but I put in a few. I put in too many. Jesus. I'm going to go put this back before it goes bad.
Yeah.
I'll be right back.
Well, I think we're wrapped on seafood there, and that was a great way to do it. But I just had to bring this up because I don't think it's anywhere else in the outline. If we're talking about imitation stuff, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the Aldi horsemeat kerfuffle of recent years. I don't quite remember. I think it was just a couple years ago.
2013.
Okay, so a few more than recent, but. The chain of German in origin supermarkets, Aldi, conducted a test on some of their ready-made beef dishes, you know, frozen things, and it was from a supplier named Comigel, and tests revealed that 30 to 100% of these beef products were actually horse meat.
No.
Yeah. And they withdrew them. And this is a thing. This can be confirmed. This actually happened. This is not a conspiracy theory. And I think, Ben, we've talked about this. You have interesting takes on horse meat. There's some Asian countries where you've been to where it is pretty readily available. And I believe you tried it and didn't think it was too bad.
Mm-mm. No, not too bad at all. But not.
But you want to know. You want to know.
That's the thing. You want to know. I don't think anybody is looking back fondly on 2013 as that time I got tricked into eating horse meat. This also, Aldi got the most press for this, but that supplier you mentioned was supplying several other companies in Sweden and I want to say France. The counterfeiting problem in food is a multi-layered conspiracy, and it occurs all the time all around us. In fact, by the way, we're probably going to see more of it unless there's some pretty robust legislation down the pike. As maritime ecosystems collapse, you know, you're going to see more and more confusing seafood.
Uh-huh. I do have to add this last thing, and then I'm done on this topic. The dishes in question at Aldi, to be fair, were called today's special frozen beef lasagna and today's special frozen spaghetti bolognese. So, you know, it was special beef, a.k.a. horse beef.
Yeah. And especially, you know, given that consuming that type of flesh is taboo in the West. This is
big
not
time.
Yeah, this is not like finding out, you know, that you were you ordered chicken and you got a duck. You know, no. What I mean? These are very different things.
It's sort of almost the equivalent of like being a vegetarian and being dosed with like chicken meat. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it's a little different, but it's that level of like, if you found this out, it was against all of your principles. Like eating a horse would be like the worst possible thing you could imagine. Like it could shake your whole culinary worldview and really like cause some serious PTSD for some people.
Agreed. And speaking of trauma, fear, speculation, let's pause for a word from our sponsor and we'll dive into some urban legends. And we are back. This is a weird one. Write to us, conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com, if you have heard of a theory like this. There's a long-running idea, or theory we can call it, that certain beverages are meant to promote sterilization or to prevent sexual activity through some ingredient, some additive that's put into the mix. This is a long-running concept in parts of world militaries, and this is a concept that's pretty common in the U.S. prison system, right? They'll say, hey, the stuff they're giving you to drink may be like rendering you sexually dysfunctional for a time. Or the very far extreme is that this will somehow permanently sterilize a person. And it makes sense that these two ideas would come from places with a large male population, right? And that has to live in close quarters, which is kind of unnatural for people. The thing is, there's not any proof of this. If you have proof from maybe your time in the armed forces or something, then we would love to hear it. But have you guys ever heard of this theory?
Well, I mean, not intentional. Like, wasn't there a thing where certain dyes maybe would render people sterile or not promote proper growth of reproductive cells, like yellow number 5 and things like that? Or did I make that up?
There have been rumors about various food additives, food colors, and a couple other things like stabilizers. We talked about, what was the one we talked about a little while ago that was in Mountain Dew? God, it was a long time. I think it was 2014 maybe we talked about that. But it's a flame retardant chemical or something that exists within a lot of citrus beverages that causes that cloudy look.
Oh, bromide.
Brominated.
Yes.
Something. Vegetable oil? No.
Yes, exactly.
Is that true?
Brominated vegetable oil is what I recall it being.
Yeah. It emulsifies citrus-flavored soft drinks. There's a lot of issue with that. But Ben, to answer your question, I don't know anything about some kind of larger conspiracy to, you know, sterilize people through some kind of drink or substance like that.
Yeah. It's kind of a subgenre that bears something in common with the belief that substance X is added to a common resource like water, right, for some nefarious purpose. So it's similar to the old fluoridation stories. Fluoride is added to water. That part is true. But with this, there are some weird questions, right? There are some holes in this concept. First one being, how do you regulate a dosage? That's the same issue you run into with the fluoride theories and other related ones. But the scary thing about this is that it doesn't come from nowhere, right? It has a past and a precedent, because theories and speculation regarding population control in the United States are firmly rooted in Uncle Sam's very real and very disturbing practice of eugenics. Like, the government of the United States actively did sterilize people multiple times. And it's weird that it doesn't get mentioned as often as it should.
Yeah, we've talked about a couple of different episodes on, for various reasons, just the terrible history that the United States has with eugenics and how it actually appears to have influenced a certain regime out in Germany.
Right. And it might surprise a lot of our U.S. listeners to know the first eugenics-based compulsory sterilization law in human history was passed here in the U.S. Indiana in 1907 made humanity's first law of this sort, and other people just copied Indiana. The Virginia Sterilization Act in 1924 called for patients in mental institutions to be sterilized against their will.
This is when they threw around all those really, you know, offensive terms for people with low IQs, correct?
Mm-hmm, right. Yeah.
This is another one of those things and rumors that, as you're saying, it feels true. Because if you think about a prison population, let's just take that as an example. There would be motive for those who run the prison to keep the inmates, you know, the population as calm as possible, right? There would be motivation for that desire. And if you could achieve that by applying some, what was it, extra ingredient to, you know, whatever food supply or drink supply that you've got providing for them, you know, it would be easily achieved. However, you know, I don't have any proof. I don't think we have any proof to show that it's happening at even one particular prison or something like that. But it definitely feels real.
Yeah, that's the thing. So we couldn't find any solid confirmation about this. It's just, it's very common. One of the ingredients that you hear a lot in these theories is saltpeter. And someone will say that saltpeter is added to maybe not just the water, but the food as well. Also, you'll hear this in boys' schools. And the idea is that it diminishes the sex drive, to your point, Matt, to make the population somewhat more sedate and easy to control.
You're saying I can take saltpeter to lower my sex drive?
Potassium nitrate. But the problem here is, no, I'm not saying that, because it doesn't work.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't work. It just sounds intelligent in conversation.
Okay.
You know, because you can find saltpeter in a ton of stuff. It's used as a preservative in food and color. It's an agent of color retention in things like bacon, corned beef, ham, hot dogs. Hey, maybe even sausages. But it's also an ice cream. So this one we can say is, so far as we can tell, is not true, but it is based in some very real, very disturbing truths. And those are, you know, there's an argument you could make that the oral tradition of this conspiratorial story is kind of our culture recounting the terrible things that occurred in the past. But now, we know you were waiting for this, folks. Yes, we are going to talk about some of those wild fast food ideas. Fast food itself is kind of a conspiracy, right? There's never been a global supply chain like this ever. You probably heard rumors that the McRib from McDonald's is so popular that it, like, skews the world pork market. You've probably had some weird fast food experiences in your old life.
Is that why they only bring it back seasonally, Ben? Because they don't want to totally upend the pork supply?
Yeah. Yeah. Cows and chickens were good all year. That's fine. But the pigs, you got to let them be for a while.
You got to wonder how much actual pork is in that McRib, too. I mean, like, I have no proof or answer to this question. I just, for some reason, have a feeling like it's a pork composite kind of situation.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Here's the thing. You can find some work on this by economists who are usually arguing that there isn't a super strong correlation between the McRib and pork prices in terms of like a causative relationship, right? They were not saying, most economists will argue that the McRib itself doesn't seem to be swinging the needle on global pork supplies, but maybe there's a different relationship. Maybe McDonald's is following the curve, right? So maybe when pork prices drop to some threshold, then they say, okay, it makes sense for us to make the McRib again.
That makes so much sense.
I mean, that makes more sense than the idea that Ronald McDonald is somewhere steepling his clown fingers and saying it's time to punish the pork people. They'll learn. Release the McRib. You know what I mean? I don't think it's quite that level. But
there is somebody in some office that hits the McRib button, though, and it's just an alert that goes out to every franchisee. They're just like, oh, it's McRib time.
I like the idea of a red phone, like an old school landline phone with no number. It's just a red phone, like the bat phone or something. And there's one person whose entire job is to every so often just pick up this phone and then say, like, do it. And then all across the world.
Yeah. They do it too. And they pick up, we're going to make apple fritters now. And then they just say the new thing.
I love it. How do you get that gig? That's sort of like dipping your toe into fast food conspiracy kind of thing, right? Because it sounds ostensibly possible. If not plausible, it sounds possible. But other stories get weird so quickly. You guys remember that before 1991, KFC used to be called Kentucky Fried Chicken? Do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
Big old signs. They were just huge with so many letters.
And then they went the way of many brands like that and, you know, wanted to simplify, go for a minimalist approach. KFC.
TLC.
The implication, what, is that the implication in the conspiracy circles, perhaps, is that chicken no longer was in play.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you guys remember when we used to make a show called Stuff They Don't Want You to Know and then it became Stididwick?
Yep. Oh, yeah. I do. It was a golden day. A PR agency was worth every penny.
So, the idea then is that there's some sort of dilution, right? The tale goes something like this. Over the years, while selling you buckets of chicken, KFC was also paying scientists to do insane experiments on poultry. And they were genetically altering these poor, unfortunate birds to the point where they might not even have heads anymore. They might just be somehow some kind of like chicken equivalent of a human centipede, right? It's just they figured out a way to just grow the breasts, the wings, and the drumsticks, etc. And now this could no longer be, as you pointed out, Noel, labeled as chicken. Whatever they did it. They took it too far. It's not chicken anymore. To be fair or foul, KFC actually responded to this one. The responses to a lot of these theories are classic, but imagine you're the PR person for KFC, and you have to say, okay, we still use chicken. We're not at the dark forefront of evil Gattaca-like genetic experimentation. But their response to this, their comeback is, I don't know, it's believable because they said, we did change the name to get rid of some words the government didn't tell us to. We just don't want people to hear the word fried.
Yeah, because for quite a while there, and even now, the word fried comes with it the connotation of super unhealthy. Like, don't eat that ever. That's the worst thing you could do to your body. Don't do that. Which isn't necessarily true, but it's also not wrong. So it's like,
I'll tell you what is one of the worst things you could possibly put in your body is the amazingly unhealthy KFC menu item, the Double Down. Do you recall this?
Is it Instead still of, in play?
I don't know if it is or not, but it was certainly was around, it was, you know, a football-y kind of themed menu item that substituted fried chicken patties for buns. So, yeah.
They weren't chicken patties. Those were breasts, my friend.
Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And they were delicious.
I bet they were.
And it has bacon. I never ate it. I think they still serve it, but I got close one time, but it was one of those, do I dare disturb the universe moments, you know?
Yes. Do I dare disturb the sleeping elder beast's slumber? That was redundant, but you get where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. Have you guys seen the delightful new Hulu reboot of the show Animaniacs?
I watched the first episode.
It's great. And they, in the first episode, it's all about like they've been like away. I don't know, maybe they were exiled or something. And they do this amazing song called the Catch Up Song that's all about everything that's happened since the 90s when the show ended and since now. And it goes through politics, it goes through like Amazon and drones and all the things. But there's a really great part where they're like, well, we don't know what's going to happen in the future because the writers are writing this in 2018 and it's not going to come out till 2020. So we'll just use our imagination. And there is an amazing verse that goes like this. We have chips in our brains. We no longer feel pain. There are worsening climate disasters. Now we live underground and we can't make a sound lest we anger our polar bear masters. We breed birds without arms on our factory farms and we live in aluminum bunkers. We sent humans to Mars. All the food comes in bars and the top rated show is called Clunkers. And then it says it's about a talking police car who's also a time machine. Wow, here comes the star, Clunko. I travel through time following crime. Okay, that's all I've got. But I just love the factory farms, birds without arms line and food in bars. I thought that was appropriate for this episode.
There you go. Man, Animaniacs. Steven Spielberg made that stuff, you guys.
He's still involved. Yeah. And it's very, very good.
That's awesome. Well, you know what? You know what you have to do a lot of when you're making animated series?
What's that?
You got to do caffeine, baby.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, some kind of upper.
Drink. Excellent segue, Matt. There's a very popular chain that's familiar to all our Canadian listeners. It's called Tim Hortons. Many of our friends up north will gladly sing the praises of a delicious cup of Tim Hortons coffee. This coffee comes
not a sponsor.
Not a sponsor. This coffee comes. I've actually never tried it. This coffee comes with a free conspiracy theory of its own. There are people who seem to, to some degree, believe that Tim Hortons was spiking its coffee with something else and that people were becoming physiologically addicted to not the caffeine necessarily, but whatever that ingredient X was.
We'll just refer to it collectively as crank.
and they said that they thought, like, the popular theory was that Tim Hortons was adding nicotine to the coffee and people were getting addicted to nicotine, and they didn't realize it because they thought they just really had to have my morning cup of coffee, which you probably already do if you are into caffeine. I'm drinking my second cup of coffee right now. I don't know if there's nicotine in it.
This episode of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is brought to you by iced coffee, home brewed or otherwise. It's what keeps us going.
And then again, a PR manager for Tim Hortons had to respond to this, which is a fun response. I like the way Michelle Robichaud put this. She says, there is, in fact, nothing added to our coffee. We believe our guests are addicted to consistency.
Oh, man.
Sick PR really burn. Good. Really put those conspiracy theorists in their place. Yeah, but this isn't the only time we've heard about this. There are other instances in the past. McDonald's, for example, was accused of adding nicotine to hamburgers.
Yeah, I mean, nicotine is the addictive thing. Like, you want to get addicted to something? Try nicotine. You'll get there real fast. So that is one of the, I guess, the go-to chemical when it comes to something feeling like it's overly addictive or more addictive than you expected it to be.
Right, right. Because also nicotine is legal. You know what I mean? It's not as if the accusation that somebody was, say, putting opioids in food wouldn't make as much sense. That seems like a lot of risk for a very weird gamble. So that you can see already that a lot of this stuff, upon further examination, may have a grain of truth as its cornerstone or its foundation, but things get carried away pretty quickly. We wanted to give you one very real one, which you may not have heard of, but it's called shrinkflation. So have you ever noticed I know we're doing a lot of Andy Rooney, like, have you ever, but have you ever noticed a sudden change in the packaging of your favorite food? Like, did you go to buy some cereal that you loved during childhood out of nostalgia and you say, hey, whoa, this box is weirdly small? You're not crazy. It's not the Mandela effect. You are experiencing shrinkflation.
Just did the other day, actually. Bought a box of Lucky Charms out of that exact impulse you're describing. Pure nostalgia. Honestly, it's one of those things where it's like, do I really want a giant bag crammed full of sugary, marshmallowy morsels, or would I be doing myself a favor by having a half-filled bag? I would go with the latter, personally. But it is a phenomenon that we've seen over time, this idea of shrinkflation.
Yeah, it's a kind of inflation. Right. But it works because of the way that human beings encounter a product. It doesn't just apply to food and beverage, but it's pretty common in those respective industries. The idea is that you can slowly reduce the size or amount of a product while maintaining its sticker price. Because one thing consumers will notice immediately when they're buying something is not necessarily the change in what they're buying, but they will notice the change in the product price, which is why, like, that's the number most people pay attention to. You might shop at some grocery store where they have the full price of something, you know, like, say, $4.99 or whatever, and then they have it broken down to cost per ounce. But very few people actually read that part. They just see $4.99. or $5.99 or $3.99, and it makes a huge impact on whether or not they buy that thing.
Yep. There's a package. The label looks familiar. This is what I always get. It's the same price, or maybe a little bit more expensive or a little bit cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
I'm good.
Mm-hmm. And manufacturers realize they could do this. They could skim just a little bit, get a little taste, a little bit more, a little bit more, retain the same price. It doesn't happen overnight. You can see it in things like the indentations at the bottom of cups, that little half sphere that just gets bigger and bigger. You can also see it in boxes, you know, like your experience with Lucky Charms. But just
for me, it was orange juice.
Orange juice, huh? What's the deal?
Just if you remember, if anyone's familiar with a gallon of orange juice or milk or something. Just a full gallon was very common, or a half gallon, at least here in the U.S. That's how you would, for a long time when I was a kid, that's how you would buy orange juice. And then, you know, with a lot of these other companies creating new orange drinks or orange juice products, mm-hmm. like we've talked about Simply Orange, I think, is one mm-hmm. of the major ones. The packaging became very different. There are these specialized bottles, and those bottles over time began to get smaller and smaller, but it was the same type of bottle, but they would get smaller and smaller. And it's gotten to the point now where several brands that I have seen actually say, you know, still 1 gallon or still however many fluid ounces or still, you know, this many milliliters. it's really interesting because it's become a marketing tool just to say, hey, we're not doing the shrinking over here.
But you still could. You could just say, like, you could say still 64 ounces, and then next year you could say still 52 ounces.
Have you guys ever noticed those, like, indentations on the side of gallons of milk or orange juice? Mm-hmm. It's like a big circle that's an indentation. It's one of these things where you'll see these like silly kind of life hack or whatever. Like, I bet you didn't know this about this thing that you've noticed every day of your life, but there's actually a story behind it. The initial version of that I saw was that button will pop out if the milk has gone bad because it's producing more gases, and that button will like pop outward. But the real reason is it allows the milk gallon to flex a little more, so it doesn't hold this rigid shape. So if one happens to fall off a truck or get dropped, it won't just explode. It gives it a little more give because that button is flexing outward, you know, as opposed to it being rigid walled container.
That's brilliant. To me, that just seems like good product design.
It really is.
Engineering, baby.
I am fascinated by the concept of it. You know, you see all this clever packaging that works. Like you have the perfect example there, Noel. It's a what seems to be a very simple solution, but holy smokes, that's got to be a game changer for the dairy industry. And maybe that's where we end, just on a slightly more sinister note. Packaging. We talked a little bit about it with shrinkflation, which is very, very real. We'd love to hear your favorite or most infamous examples of shrinkflation. But let's talk a little bit about packaging. What happens to all that stuff, you know?
Oh, well, okay. Yeah, that's a great thing to bring up. By the way, if you want to talk about packaging and intelligent design, somebody came up a long time ago with the food product pouch.
Matt, when you say intelligent design, are you referring to the notion that God is in control of our destinies?
Or? Yes. Okay, a deity cool. of some sort okay, designed these things.
Yes.
These things. Oh. They're pouches of food.
Yeah. With the little twisty top. I love those.
Well, anyone that has ever had a child or is just a fan of, you know, fruits and vegetables that are pureed down into this consistency that can fit into a bag like this. I mean, it really is a brilliant thing because there's not a ton to this. It's super simple and you can put anything in there. The problem is, instead of, you know, let's say back in the day, this is old man Matt talking. Back in the day, we used to get our applesauce in a big glass jar and you'd spoon it out and eat it individually like that. It was delicious. But now, each little serving comes in something like this. Nowadays, when you're eating applesauce or something like that, or it comes in one of these little individual, I apologize to anyone just listening to this.
Well, this is obviously going to be the YouTube clip. Let's make a note of this, Paul, okay. If you don't mind. This has got to be. This is the show and tell portion of the podcast.
Well, I'm holding up just one of these individual little plastic cups filled with, this one I think has peaches in it, but it would be like applesauce or something. And every time you consume one of those, all of that becomes trash. And even if you are recycling it, we've talked about the pitfalls of recycling, it is probably going to end up in a landfill somewhere or in an ocean somewhere. And think about right now, going through the times of COVID in 2020, just how much takeaway food you're getting, how much carryout you're getting, and all of the just the stuff that you end up throwing away every time you eat a meal like that. It's horrifying. I know in my family, we counted up the number of plastic, you know, those little packages of plastic forks and silver plasticware that you get.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We actually saved them over the course of a month. And we too frequently get takeaway. And just looking at it and quantifying it in that way was a horrifying sight.
Yeah, but it's also like something you would maybe potentially buy for like picnics or for like, you know, more low key guest situations where you maybe don't want to have to wash dishes. So those, if you take a little bit of care with those kinds of products and you stockpile them, they can be useful and it's not all waste. It's going to be waste eventually, but I'm annoyed when those things are provided when they're not asked for. And it's like,
you mean like this, Noel?
Yeah.
Little soy sauce packet. Mm-hmm. How many of these have you thrown away?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
I always keep them with the intent of using them, but then I'm like, I already have a giant bottle of soy sauce. What am I going to do with this little tiny single serving of soy sauce? You know,
I keep them.
I keep them, but then I never use them. And then I eventually purge them.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be a big downer with that stuff.
No, dude, it's just, these are things we should think about. Back to our plastics discussion at the very top of the show. These are important things. And Ben, we're talking about microplastics, right? Wouldn't that be a thing that you'd need to consider when it comes to forks and when it comes to soy sauce packets over time? Wouldn't those packages degrade and potentially cause you to ingest those microplastics?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, this has been proven. We just don't know the extent of the long-term consequences. Now, packaging is a huge deal. There are companies that will use what's called biodegradable packaging or sell you stuff in glass bottles, which is cool because you have a useful container at the end of the day. But the fact of the matter is plastic checks all the boxes for a durable thing that is cost effective. So that and shrinkflation are two very real conspiracies. One last shout out. I know everybody's been worried about this for the entirety of today's episode. We can confirm that Outback Steakhouse has denied their alleged ties with the Illuminati.
Oh, thank God.
So everybody relax. We could be cool.
Or, you know, get more on your toes because they talked about it. So, I mean, and that was in 2019. So who knows? I don't know. I think jury's out when it comes to the Outback Illuminati.
This is a real story. We don't have too much time to get into it. But a while back, someone on Twitter did a conspiracy map, and they mapped out locations of Outback steakhouses in Arizona, Georgia, Illinois, and a couple other places. And they said, look at this. These all, if you look at the arrangement here, this forms a pentagram. Is Outback Steakhouse a front for a satanic cult? Outback Steakhouse said, in another great PR statement, Outback Steakhouse said, they have no like world conquering plans other than to bring bold steaks and bloomin' onions to our guest.
Don't ever eat the bloomin' onion.
Why?
Ever. It's got an insane amount of calories in
it. Oh, yeah. Well, it's for sharing, Matt. It's for sharing.
Oh, no, it's not. It's for personal consumption. I know this for a fact. I've been there.
You've bloomed. So that's our show today. We've covered a lot of things. We hope that you enjoyed it. And Australian listeners, I've always wondered, what do you all in Australia think of Outback Steakhouse? Is it offensive? Is it like too much of a caricature?
Oh, it's got to be, know? Right?
And then there's what? Foster's, Australian for beer.
Here's my question. Do they have Outback steakhouses in Australia?
I think there is. There is one in Australia. But, you know, we can't talk too much trash about that because here in the U.S., we have American Deli.
We do. They're everywhere.
So that's our show, folks. We hope this finds you happy and in good health. And as always, we want to hear from you. We've covered some really crazy stuff that's probably not true. We've covered some things that are very true and disturbing. But we didn't cover everything. So what food-related conspiracies do you feel have serious sand? Let us know.
Yes, you can find us on social media. We are all over the place. Conspiracy Stuff on Twitter and Facebook. Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. Check out youtube.com/conspiracystuff to watch clips from this episode and all of the other ones that we do. It's quite a bit of fun. And reading the comments is a joy. And leaving a comment is, you know, I don't know what you would call that experience, but you should try it out. But that's not it. If you want to give us a call, we have a phone number.
That's right. It's 1-833-STDWYTK. Leave a message at the sound of Ben's dulcet tone. Try to keep it in their 3-minute range, 3-minute maximum. If it's really juicy and you need to call back, it will cut you off after 3. But, you know, do your best. Brevity is the soul of wit, as they say. And you might find your story on one of our weekly listener mail episodes.
And if none of that quite bags your badgers, we have one way that you can always contact us, regardless of the time of year and time of day, or what you're eating. And that is our good old-fashioned email address, where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.